amount of land is the ability to integrate the solution with the land use. Where you've got fractured land ownership, it's really hard, and I'm seeing it more and more in my new role. I've recently changed jobs, but I'm seeing it more and more how hard it is with fractured land ownership to get an integrated solution with stormwater that achieves all the outcomes we want, which are not just stormwater outcomes, but are amenity and community outcomes as well. And with this solution, that's part of what we've tried to achieve here, is that integrated approach where we can, an improved stream system. I would have loved to have seen two open channels through there, but operationally it just doesn't work.
Well, presumably, if a council was going to zone today, it'd be doing exactly the same sort of things that you're doing, but this is going to be a private facility, self-contained.
Look, I'm not sure what the long-term ownership would be, because I guess why I say that is when I look at my sticky outy bits here, they're also taking a public road. So it's not just taking Kiwi Rail land, and I don't know where those are going to go. So I haven't made any assumptions yet on ultimate ownership and maintenance responsibilities. But by and large, yes, it's private facility. But I just haven't made any assumptions yet.
No.
Okay. So in terms of my summary, I think in terms of discussing the system generally, that's as far as I was going to go. I just thought I'd talk with the council officer's report on stormwater. Largely, we're in agreement. There's a few minor points that they've come up with, but they've agreed that in terms of the designation footprint, it's adequate to mitigate stormwater effects. And I think that is partly because we agreed methodology early, stuck to it, and they're largely happy with that. We're also in agreement that further work is required at the consenting phase. And as I've said, I don't want to understate how much work that is. I think there's that modelling work is months of work.
I think you're right. I think it's quite a big job.
But that is the consenting phase job. That's what we would expect, whether it was a designation or not, to get the resource consent. Just the modelling for the flooding, but then the environmental effects side as well. So there's a lot more work needed at consent phase. We're in agreement on that. I think that's all I want to say. Also, the other area we're in agreement on is that the concerns raised in the submissions can be adequately addressed during the detailed design phase, given the footprint that we have. So we were in agreement there as well. And I have looked at the submissions and submission themes in more detail in my evidence in chief, if you want to discuss that further. There are a couple of outstanding issues, really, and they relate to the consent conditions, particularly the conditions sent through on Friday.
Yes.
So I thought I might just mention those. Now, is this the right page number?
Reference the condition number.
Okay, you'll give the page number. Okay, so conditions 37 to 40, those are the council's 37 to 40.
Page
12, the Friday edition. Okay, go for it. The NOR proposed conditions talked about a stormwater management report, and that was to address the flooding issues, and a stormwater maintenance and monitoring plan, which was about addressing the more the water quality side and the stormwater management on-site stormwater management side. In my technical report, I had talked about a stormwater management framework, which was what I envisaged would be needed for resource consent phase. And I'd put in there all the items and a contents page of the items I considered would need to be addressed in a stormwater management framework to enable resource consent to be granted. The officers have come back and said, we want a condition requiring the stormwater management framework report. All the things they want in that report, I agree with them, they needed from a resource consent stage. Are they required to support the designation? I don't think so. But I am going to hand off to Ms. Bell there on those the planning framework. From a technical end, though, it's what I'd expect to be required for resource consent.
So I suppose that comes down to a practical question, which is if you do anything on the site that increases the amount of water, you're in a discharge situation. So you're automatically into a consenting phase, whatever happens. And there might be a potential redundancy here.
Yes.
That's the sort of theory,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Discharges are a regional council issue. And they'll, you know, as soon as you breach the permitted activity status, which I suspect on this site we'll do in about 5 seconds flat, you trigger the need for a regional consent.
Yes.
That's my dumb engineer's version.
Yeah. Well, I certainly understand. Yeah, I mean, we'll just hear from the council too, but I understand what you're saying. But what problem? In an administrative sense, is it a problem that a document that might, so for example, you put in a stormwater management framework, which the council says that's fine. Then you go to the regional council and say that's not fine. Have you then breached your condition? Is that an administrative issue that is potentially real?
Yeah, I'm going to hand that off to Ms. Bell. I can talk the technical side, but those procedural ends are not my strength.
Okay, that's fine. So I've just made a note. Mr. Leahy concerned, but passes to Ms. Bell.
Pass the mic, yes.
Okay.
If I could, I'd pass it to Mr. Skelton, but he's been already. Okay, so that is that was 37 to 40. And then conditions 41, 42 and 43, which relate to erosion and sediment control. So that page.
That's council proposed conditions 41 and
yes,
onwards.
Yes, correct.
Okay, so that's a deletion of yours and an insertion of new ones? Or?
So yeah. The conditions above deletion of our 41, et cetera, was a stormwater management and monitoring plan.
Yeah.
And then Mr. Leahy's about to speak, there's a proposed addition of an erosion and sediment control plan.
Yeah.
So if you had a stormwater management and monitoring plan recommended as a condition, how is that different from their recommended stormwater management framework report?
Their stormwater management framework report includes all of that and the flood modelling stuff and the stormwater management report. So it includes all of the above. As I say, it's technically work that needs doing. It's just there's that procedural issue that I've been advised of, which I'm handing
off. What I would be interested to know from Ms. Bell is QL still with what I see as deletions of conditions subdivisions 41 to 44.
No.
And how, in her mind, the framework report is a bridge too far. I'm just not clear about that in my own mind. Sorry, 41.
Yeah, so the new proposed 41 to 43, really exactly the same issue as I talked about with stormwater management framework. Erosion and sediment control of the scale we'll be dealing with is very much a regional council activity. We will trigger regional council rules there. And it's the, while the detail in here, it's exactly what I'd expect to have to do for regional council consents. There's even a nod to that in the advice note at the bottom of condition 43. But it's the same thing. This is a regional council issue. From a technical perspective, yes, I expect we have to deal with all those issues.
It's not uncommon, though, to have a erosion sediment control condition, even in a territorial authority consent, although I accept it's more conventional than regional, isn't it?
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Common.
More and more less common to have erosion and sediment control conditions than TA consents.
Less and less common.
Yeah.
But would the condition work that that sufficient for the stormwater management and for the earthworks consents, there is a regional consent in place? In other words, in a sense, once you get the regional consents, the conditions of the designation are deemed to be satisfied. Is that a way of working it or not?
Oh, once again, I'm just going to step back on the process.
Ms. Bell can
address
that one.
And I might get Ms. Sweetman. She does a lot more of those conditions than I do.
I'm not here to give
Well, I can ask questions, but I'm just wondering, my experience has been that it's not uncommon to see those types of conditions in territorial authority consents. They're almost de rigueur in regional consent, I accept that. But Ms. Bell can speak to that. Sorry.
Right. So in terms of my quick summary, what I intended to say, and then I thought I might address three questions that Mr. Skelton kindly handed on to me, if that's okay, unless there are other questions.
No, go ahead. We'll have questions after you finish.
Okay. The first question was about the construction of this central culvert, and do we do it on the line of the stream? Effectively, inlet point is fixed, outlet point is fixed. We've got to join the dots. But it's from a construction perspective, it's much more complex to construct. We've got a stream flowing through. We would try to be constructing it off to the side of the stream and then divert it in as a final matter. Now, I haven't looked at the detail of how the water course goes and the detail of that construction. That is a design issue. But we wouldn't try and construct online. It's just too hard. The second option is there might be local diversions need to be put in to enable us to get the appropriate line for the culvert, but you wouldn't normally try and construct it online. It's just too hard, especially, we've got a catchment there of 600 hectares. If it rains a bit, there's going to be a lot of water coming through.
What's the distance between the inlet and the outlet?
From memory, 650 metres.
And it won't have any natural...
The watercourse at the moment, it's not dead straight, but it doesn't have a lot of meanders in it.
Right. it's not actually a particularly complex morphology.
No, not at all. Most of the watercourses, and Mr. Garrett Walker will be able to talk to this in more detail from his ecological appraisal, but from my walk over, most of them are, they appear to me to be artificially constructed. And you can see it quite well with this one to the north here. A dead straight watercourse, that tells the story.
Yeah, so
they've been well modified over the generations.
Yeah. What distance did you say?
650 meters.
I'd sort of put it at 700, but would that be roughly right?
Yeah. I got that from someone else. I'm not quite sure where.
I'm just using my ruler of scale, but you're about right.
Yeah, it's in that ballpark. So so the first one was, would we construct online and generally construct offline and then hook in? So you construct offline, hook the outlet in before you connect the inlet. In this case, there'll be complications around timing and everything with the rest of the construction works, the exact alignment. We'll need to look at foundations of buildings, how they all interact. So all that will be part of that detailed design process. So that was the first question. Second question was maintenance of the culvert. I thought that was a very good question. It's a long culvert. There's no two ways around that. I've dealt with culverts 100, 200 metres long. This one's the longest I've been involved with. But in an urban context, and certainly a historical stormwater context, long piping of streams has certainly been done many times historically in an urban context. This culvert, the existing culvert under the railway on the eastern side, is about 10 square metres in cross-sectional area. It's 2.7 metres high by 3.7 metres wide. It's a reasonably meaty culvert, more than big enough to walk through. I'm anticipating, given climate change effects, you're looking at something in the order of a 40% increase in rainfall intensity. So, you know, if I just do a really rough, say, hey, that's a 50% increase in flow. So I'm anticipating a 10 square metre culvert. It's going to need to be 15 square metres in the design scenario. So that's two big box culverts, 4 metres by 3 metres, with beds buried a bit to allow for a natural bed form to form in them to help with fish passage. So they're big beasts, and they're certainly walkable. Low flows in the stream over summer are very low to non-existent. So any maintenance access, you'll be targeting doing that in the dry periods. In terms of debris blockage, the highest risk point is the inlet to the culvert, because any tree trunks flowing down, that's where they're going to hit a barrier first, so you've got access to that.
So in terms of managing that risk to stop the effect of, it's a natural, in a sense, an artificial barrier that's created a risk. How do you manage that?
That risk is there now, of course. By putting in two culverts, that's actually one way of helping manage that risk, because one side, especially if you change your invert, so one slightly lower than the other, so it becomes your primary flow. If that blocks, your consequences are much less by having that other one kept open. Managing the hydraulics of that flow path at the inlet, maybe even providing some extra inlet capacity that comes then into the culvert. So at the design stage, I think that's one of the key things that needs to be considered, because that inlet blockage is the biggest risk. Although with culverts this size, it's nowhere near as bad as if it was only sort of a metre diameter culvert. Because it takes, you're not going to get branches blocking this sort of culvert. It's tree trunks.
How do you deal with security issues of children?
I loved walking through them when I was a kid. I really struggle with that one, to be honest. Security grills are the classic answer, but the design criteria on those is like a stair riser. The gap has to be less than 120 mil, and that's going to block a devil of a lot faster than the open culvert. So you can fence around. At the moment, there's a big culvert there now. You can fence up to the culverts, maybe have a pool of water at the entry to discourage the kids walking through. If you put a safety grill on, there are design guidelines for them. They end up with the surface area of the safety grill being something like 30 or 40 times the surface area of your culvert because of that increased risk of blockage. But there are design criteria there. I prefer, if I can, not to go there.
All right, so what's the last question?
There was a third question. What was that? Can the site elevation be dropped? Mr. Skelton quite rightly said I was pushing him to keep it up as much as possible. What I'm dealing with is it's not about the flood level. The flood level, make a note of it. The flood level for the 200-year flood I haven't got it handy there, downstream of the site from memory at this location was about RL41. And at this location up here, about RL45. So at weathered sites at 49, 49.5 or 50, it's well above the flood level from the Mangaoni stream. What I have got, though, and if I look at it this way, the most extreme part of the site is up here. I have to be able to run a drainage line because I don't want to discharge to this watercourse we want to recreate here. I have to be able to run a drainage line down there, across here, and down here, and still get into this point and allow it to fill with water as it's acting as a detention pond. So, and my pipes are going to have 1.5 to 2 metres of cover, plus I need falls from those pipes. So I need something like 4 or 5 metres fall to come down through the site. So it's once we get into the detailed design, that's when we'll start refining things. But at this stage, I was pushing to get as much latitude as I could so that I could say, yes, I'm confident this will work. And then we can refine from there at the detailed stage.
When you said that you were finding your current work difficulty about getting all those pieces together when you've got multiple sites, is that partly connected with intensification in Auckland and trying to get managed stormwater?
The sites I'm thinking of in particular are greenfields.
Oh, they are.
Multiple ownership.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's a question from Mr. Bent. I'm not going to be responsible for its accuracy or thing, but this question is, assuming there has been no rain for some time, so that the 3 pond levels are minimal, what rainfall would be required over the NOR site to fill the 3 ponds so that the discharge is as described? So I presume he means by is as described, you're getting that. And maybe you can't answer that because that's a...
In terms of millimetres, no, I can't answer that. But what we've looked at is the 200-year, 24-hour storm.
Yes.
And that's how we've set aside the volume. We've said the difference in volume from pre-development to post-development in a 200-year, 24-hour storm, that's the volume we want to set aside. And I can't tell you what rainfall depth that comes to. I think the volume of storage was something in the order of 80,000 cubic metres.
That makes sense.
Mr. Leahy, thank you, and thanks for taking us through how it was going to work on site. That's been incredibly helpful. I was very interested about where you're working now, and particularly why so was a question from the chair yesterday, in terms of the relationship between the NPSFM and the NPSUD, because I can imagine as principal growth planning at Auckland Council Healthy Waters, that's something you're grappling with.
Yes.
Yes.
Grappling being an operative word, not an outcome yet.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
So the chair was particularly interested in, and I am, equally so, about the tension between obviously objective one of the NPSFM and the objectives around Te Mana o Te Wai. Well, and the NPSUD about ensuring that there is sufficient land for development capacity, you know, all of the rest of that.
And intensification.
And
yes.
Intensification and the like. So having considered those two, what's your advice to us in terms of how this proposal sits with both of those national policy statements?
I don't think I can give you advice. I just, that's something I haven't looked at in this regard, and I'd have to turn my mind to it. I think to answer that question properly, I've got to sit down and do a whole lot more thinking than I have done. Mm-hmm. So call it a cop-out, it's not been something I've had to apply my thinking to in this case.
That's fine. It is, yeah. I can imagine not have been your brief in terms of this particular circumstance, but...
No,
just very interested in your current role, and something you are dealing with.
As I tell people that in this current role, I've still got my training wheels on. I've been a stormwater engineer in consultancy for a long time, and I've now challenged myself with throwing myself into something quite different, and I still have my training wheels on, which is quite a challenge at this stage of my career.
So you talked about low-impact design,
yes,
as well as being something fundamental underpinning,
yes,
how you've approached this as well. Have you considered the Urban Water Working Group's Urban Water Principles in doing so?
I was on that working group.
So was I.
Yes, yep. I haven't specifically considered them, but they're all consistent with those. The one thing is I don't consider low-impact design an outcome. It's a process. It's a tool that helps us achieve a series of outcomes, but in itself it isn't an outcome. So when I'm an engineer, I'm looking for, well, what's it mean? What's the end result? And low impact design for me is a tool to help me achieve some of those results. And on those regular flows, it can be a really good tool.
No, thank you. Otherwise, I found your evidence very easy to understand. So, thank you.
I'm pleased for that.
Kia ora, Mr. Leahy.
Kia ora.
Thank you very much for your evidence, and to reiterate, the thanks expressed also by my colleague. I'd like to also express mine. I found your evidence really easy to follow, given that it is such a technical and somewhat complicated area for me to understand coming from the background that I do. So I really appreciate the way in which you've put it together. And the further elaborations that you've provided for us this afternoon have also been really helpful. Just to take the issue of the low impact design systems a little bit further, I'm just wanting to understand, I guess, to what degree you see it possible within the scope of this particular site to incorporate low impact design systems into into the stormwater management.